battle for survival of Western civilization. It's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, World Affairs Brief. Hi, Joel. How are you doing tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Happy to be with you.
So what are we going to talk about this evening? What are the major issues facing America this week?
Well, this week the major issue really is the U.S.-China summit. And it's my lead story for tomorrow in the World Affairs Brief, so I'll give your listeners a preview.
Okay.
Chinese President Hu Jintao made, as expected, non-specific promises to cooperate on a number of sensitive issues. But the U.S. gained absolutely nothing from this show of diplomacy, except to allow China, of course, to reap what I call a huge propaganda victory. That is, it's projecting its image as a world power able to stand its ground with the U.S. And the only positive spin President Bush could utter in this whole thing today was, well, we can be candid about our disagreements, meaning that he didn't get any ironclad commitments or changes out of who at all. So it's my analysis that there are two separate agendas at work here. First, there's a public agenda to reinforce the public perception that the U.S. is aware of the future China threat and trying to address these issues. But there's a secondary agenda, and that is no intention to do anything about it. It starts out, you know, the U.S. feeds the press with a list of U.S., quote, concerns. And I'll give you a list because it's each of these are major concerns. There's the trade deficit, the overvaluation of the Chinese currency, which is related to that, sanctions on Iran. China is not supporting sanctions on Iran. North Korea's nuclear program. China's really not twisting North Korea's arm about that. Taiwan's non-independence, human rights violations in China, pirated music and software, not to mention China's ravenous appetite for new oil and gas, which is causing, at least giving the big oil companies an excuse to justify price increases. And last, and probably least, shouldn't be least, but China's military intentions. Those are the major concerns, and it's a big list. But Bush is only playing like he's chastising China by, game about downgrading the summit to a state visit, from a state visit, which is a different form of protocol, to a mere official visit. And this determines how much official protocol is offered to the Chinese. Bush provided a formal lunch, for example, instead of a large state dinner. But most of the analysis see this fifth meeting between these two leaders as mostly symbolic. Bush himself had originally proposed that the summit take place at his ranch in Texas, where the two men could spend much of a day together on relative issues. But Hu, who became president of China in 2003, insisted on a more official venue. That means he's looking for the official protocols that will give China the most prestige. China's prestige and honor is very important there. So Beijing wanted a state visit, got downplayed, but the formal talks were downgraded only to an hour, hardly long enough to resolve even one of the major issues of contention, let alone the strategic threats.
All right, well, you hang on there. We're going to be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joel Skousen, and we're talking about the visit of the Premier of China to the United States. And, you know, of course, the thing is that there is terribly ruthless treatment of political opponents in China. There's no freedom there. Certainly you can move around if you want to, but if you speak out against the government, if you use the internet, if you express any disrespect for the leadership over there, why they simply take away your freedom. And there's still a great deal of talk about, you know, the way that they execute people over there and sell their organs. And although the Chinese have said, well, we're not going to continue, you know, executing people and selling their organs, apparently they're still doing it. I mean, total disregard for human values, everything America stands for, and yet our leaders are doing everything they can to help China build up its tremendous economic potential, American corporations, American banks, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Eastern Development Bank, the International Agency for Development, all pouring massive amounts of aid into communist China to build up this potential enemy. It really doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does if you understand the globalist objectives that are underlying the Bush administration agenda, this private agenda. As I say, I'm trying to give a picture of the dichotomy that I see between the public agenda, which is caution and concern about China's military intentions and watchfulness. But I believe that this is merely a cover. The private agenda, the secret agenda, indicates that the government is merely giving lip service to these issues with China, but no sanctions for China's human rights violations, no sanctions for its offensive military buildup against Taiwan, a huge military buildup, belying its intentions to resolve the Taiwan issue peacefully, its transfer of missile and nuclear technology to China. There's no sanctions for that for China in particular. There's sanctions only to one or two small Chinese companies. And China's also giving military aid to the Sudan, which is involved in the persecution of the major Christian elements in there, as well as in Burma. And not to mention the not-so-veiled threat to nuke L.A., California, you know, if the U.S. gets in its way in Taiwan. So the U.S. gives lip service to China, or to sanctions, but it doesn't give real sanctions. It's business as usual here.
And, of course, China is one of the major backers of Mugabe, President Mugabe in Zimbabwe, where there's just cruel and ruthless treatment of the blacks as well as the whites there. And, of course, this is the regime that we brought to power and promised that if there was ever the end of the rule of law, we would come to the help of the people. And, of course, we have refused to carry out our promises, which, of course, would cause everybody in the world to seriously question the value of an American promise. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest, Joel Skousen. Joel, why don't you pick up the story there?
Now, second on the private agenda is a desire to allow China to promote its economic ties to the eager lapdogs of American corporations that want to do business with China, Microsoft and Starbucks Coffee in the Washington State special dinner that they had at the home of Bill Gates. Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft were there. Those are the two of the big Washington hands left over from the Kissinger days in the Nixon administration. And these are what I consider some of the second echelon people in the globalist hierarchy, what I call the powers that be that control the Bush administration. So it was very appropriate that they were there. Third agenda is to provide you WHO with a prestigious forum at the Yale University to speak. You know, they didn't have to do any of this. If this is a country guilty of human rights violations, whether it's Saddam Hussein or the dictator of North Korea or Iran, they would never be allowed to come to the United States and be given this kind of honors. But China is, despite these terrible human rights violations, which frankly make at least Iran pale by comparison. North Korea is another story. But the Bush administration also made it hard on Chinese protesters to embarrass you. They succeeded anyway at the opening ceremonies. Dr. Wang Wenyi, a pathologist and Falun Gong practitioner, gained entrance with a press pass and heckled you from the press gallery until security hauled her away. And fifth agenda, to muzzle members of Congress who might try to embarrass you by demanding that Bush put substance to his concerns. Newsmax reporter Charles R. Smith said this week, the word inside Capitol Hill is that President Bush personally met with Senate and House leaders from both parties and demanded that they keep silent on China. The move by President Bush followed a fury of activity over this no-bid contract that I talked about a couple of weeks ago in the World Affairs Brief, where they awarded to Hutchinson Wampow, a Chinese military front company, all the operations of a sophisticated radiation detection system in the Bahamas. So supposedly checking for security invasions via U.S. ports. And the president reportedly told Democrat and Republican leaders that they both keep in line relative to the critics in Congress. So, as I said, if Bush had been serious about these Chinese threats, and it is serious, I mean, let there be no doubt about it, after Russia, China is the next greatest threat. Now, some of your listeners who haven't heard my analysis before may say, what do you mean Russia is a threat? Well, I'll later on in the brief I'll explain, of course, that I think that Russia is engineering a major deception. The fall of the Soviet Union is secretly preparing for a preemptive strike on America, and part of its plan is that requires that China be ready to back it up and to go along with it. And so one of the reasons why China or Russia is threatening or feigning weakness is to give China a chance to catch up, which she is rapidly. But if he were serious about the Chinese threat, he would have refused to meet with you until China actually made substantive progress in human rights. He would have denied you a visa to his promotional events. He would have sanctioned all high-tech trade to China, even non-military trade, because there is crossover there, and encouraged other nations to do the same, just like he's doing with China's surrogates, North Korea and Iran.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting. I was just thinking of Tiananmen Square, because I remember Tiananmen Square very well. And, you know, what a horrible affront to these concepts of democracy and human rights that that President Bush touts so widely. But I remember, of course, in 1989, when George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush presidency, was there, and the world was offended as we saw the just gross mistreatment of the students who were demonstrating with signs that, you know, about democracy and Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, what was America going to do? Well, what America did was, within a few days, the first President Bush gave most favored nation trading status to Communist China, something they'd wanted for a long time. Had that been withheld, why, it certainly would have been a terrible affront to them and might very well have brought them to the bargaining table to give more freedom. Instead of that, with no concessions at all, we gave China most favored nation trading status as a reward for what had happened, and the average American shook their head and said, gee, we don't understand that, and Bill Clinton said, gee, what a terrible thing to do, and then when he got to be president, he did exactly followed the same path that George Herbert Walker Bush had followed, and of course, George W. Bush said, oh, Clinton's a terrible person, he's getting us into all these wars, yeah. He got us into this unnecessary war, nation building in Bosnia, nation building in Kosovo, I would never do that. And then when he got to be the president, he did far worse things than Bill Clinton ever did. So the American people have to remember the past, because George Santayana said, those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it.
Well, in light of that, and that was a very good introduction to what I was going to cover next.
I'll go right ahead.
there is a game that the Bush team is playing, and it's the same game that we've played ever since, even before World War II, because these globalists have really been in charge of our government and controlled various presidencies to more or less of a degree since before World War I. But it's the same game they played with Hitler's rearmament prior to World War II and Russia's Cold War arms buildup. And its aim is to set the stage for future world conflict. They set the stage for World War I. We got us a war. It didn't lead to the total world government that they had wanted. The globalists gave us World War II. And the way they did that was create an enemy by funding Hitler and Stalin, or Lenin before Hitler, funding the communist resurgence. And a lot of people may be shocked about this, but it's very, very true and been well documented on a book by Anthony Sutton, Wall Street and Hitler, and other books subsequent to that. But here's the basic plan. First of all, you secretly supply the future enemy with financing and military technology to facilitate the buildup. Certain Wall Street firms financed Hitler, Lenin and Stalin, and the Roosevelt administration gave Russia the plans and nuclear material to become a nuclear power during World War II, that which they couldn't steal. Now, today, all American businesses are financing China's manufacturing growth in the headlong rush for profits. And military technology transfers to China started in earnest in the late 80s during the Herbert Walker Bush presidency, when he directed military contractors like Hughes Aerospace to open their plants to the Chinese. I had a subscriber then that was working for Hughes, and he was sending me emails about how the Chinese had to run the place, and especially the top secret divisions of Hughes. And when they got together and put together a protest to the company about the Chinese being there in their plant, they locked the workers out on Saturdays and gave the Chinese the whole run of the plant on Saturdays where the workers couldn't be there to see it. And as he investigated that, he found out they had orders from the White House that they were to give the Chinese access. Now, this all reached hemorrhage proportions during the Clinton administration, as you pointed out. The Bush Commerce Department still does technology transfers in secret to China. They've got a special division in the Commerce Department which does that. It's not public knowledge. While they place temporary sanctions on select Chinese firms, just as a show of strength, they put through major technology transfers through the Commerce Department. As columnist Charles R. Smith of Newsmax noted, he says the Chinese missile proliferation to Iran brought about sanctions to some of the specific PLA, that's People's Liberation Army of China, PLA-owned companies involved with that missile transfer. However, the Bush administration officially gave the Chinese government a waiver against broader sanctions that should have been imposed due to the weapons sale to Iran, because certainly this had the approval of the entire Chinese government.
And of course, the thing that's so interesting, Joel, along with that, is that we see some poor little Chinese guy who does ship something over to his uncle over in China, you know, that it could be used for military technology, and maybe he really is a spy, and maybe he really is, you know, shipping something that he shouldn't, and yet we make a big deal out of that, and we're going to put him in prison, and he's made a plea deal, and he's going to go off to prison, and yet, of course, officially, we're doing this behind the scenes, so you make an issue of something, and so we say, oh, well, they're really clamping down, but it's all for show. The policy of our country is to transfer our military technology to communist China without letting the American people realize what's going on.
And the reasons, of course, is building up the best money, enemy that money can buy, as you have said many times on your program. And the reason is it's very difficult for Americans to get a handle on this kind of a suicide, what appears to be a suicidal philosophy, but it's not suicide at all. The history is that the globalists use world conflict in order to enforce change upon the world that they would not otherwise accept. And it takes a war for people to cry out and allow their freedoms to be limited so that they can, so that globalists can do away by force with national sovereignty, which is the target of this next war that's upcoming, that they're heading us in that direction. Now, the second tactic they use is to express concern about the military buildup. Whether it was Hitler, they expressed concern. Whether it was Russia, they expressed concern. And in China now, the Pentagon comes out with this biennial military view, and China is considered the top military threat. It really is Russia, and they're covering for Russia still. But China is a threat, but they do nothing substantive about it. That's the tactic. They use diplomatic negotiations to lull the American people into the idea that their leaders are trying to halt the aggression or trying to engage the enemy. The Europeans were permissive with Hitler's illegal rearmament, even though they had the justification to intervene militarily under the Versailles Treaty. We coddled Russia until it was too strong to attack. It didn't have devastating effects so far to us because that threat has merely been postponed. As I said, because I think Russia has pulled off the greatest, grandest deception of our century in feigning the fall of communism while they rearm and take our money and we take over the support of the Eastern European countries, which supposedly went free.
And of course, the thing is that I can't believe that the people at the upper echelons, the Kissingers and the David Rockefellers, don't know what's really going on. But I do believe that the average individual is totally confused by what's going on, and that's exactly what's intended to be. He's not to be allowed to realize we're creating the best enemy money could buy. Well, Joel picked that story right up there.
Well, as for China, engagement is still the watchword for the times of the times in hopes of so-called moderating China's aims for revenge on China. And believe me, they do have a revenge motive to get back at Japan for World War II, and a hegemony motive, that is, they want worldwide control, even so much that they will eventually attack Russia itself, I believe during World War III, just as Russia went against Hitler after they'd had a mutual non-aggression pact. Charles Smith, once again of Newsmax, correctly calls this appeasement. He makes this statement, and I quote, "Engagement equals appeasement. Major corporations see dollars in China. These guys have won the China debate on Capitol Hill since 1990. He says, the sum of their argument is that China will become nice if we engage it through trade. And you've heard that, of course, but it isn't true. He says, the engagement crowd has been preaching this line for 17 years, and I say, my comment is not including the history of appeasement in Germany and Russia. And so far, China's not gotten any nicer or less belligerent. And Russia didn't either, by the way, Dr. Stan, as you know. It just faked its own demise in 1989 to feign weakness prior to striking the West when China's ready to help. And in fact, China has previously been cited as the source of missile, nuclear, chemical, and biological weapon sales to Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Pakistan, North Korea, and Libya. And one thing that Charles R. Smith misses in that list is that with the exception of Pakistan, Russia has been actually the main supplier in Iran, Iraq, and Sudan, and North Korea, and Libya. And China has been the backup supplier when Russia attempts to play the role of ally of the U.S. As Russia moves out of Cuba, China takes over. As Russia moves out of Venezuela, China goes back in. So they're working in dovetail one another. So he's a little bit off and only pointing the finger at China. One of the reasons is, even as a conservative, Charles R. Smith is the subject of beneficial leaks from insiders within the U.S. Bush administration. They only feed him leaks about China because they want an opposition building against China. They want to express concern about China. But all of this is primarily as well a cover for Russia, who is way ahead of China in terms of its ability to strike us with nuclear missiles, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. In one case, Charles R. Smith says detailed Chinese blueprints of an atomic bomb were turned over to U.S. intelligence officials by Libya. When Libya cleaned out, and supposedly went clean as to its nuclear ambitions and its weapons of mass destruction, it ended up turning those Japanese or Chinese blueprints to the U.S., indicating that Chinese had been selling nuclear technology to Libya. Let's see. To show how engagement is the watchword in the White House, the AP reported that in this news conference after the summit, in a toast to the Chinese leader, Bush saluted China as an ancient civilization which had moved in a generation from isolationism to, quote, engagement and expansion with the world. So he's praising engagement. In his reply, Hu said that China will keep firmly to the path of peaceful development and will always live in peace with other countries.
And if anybody, of course, believes that, really doesn't know much about the history of either China as a whole or certainly of communist China. Specifically, we'll be right back with Joel Skousen. All right, Dr. Stan, we'll go right ahead, Joel, and we've been talking certainly about how President Bush is toasting President Hu and you're saying how wonderful they are and how certainly we want to have engagement with them. And of course, the President of China is assuring everybody that China only wants to live in peace with the rest of the world. And, of course, neither man is telling the truth.
The fourth strategy, and let me just review from your other listeners, the first strategy, of course, is to feed military and financial and military technology to the future enemy. Second is...
You're talking about America feeding technology to communist
right.
China.
In other words, building up an enemy in order to create conflict. That's right. the tactic, this long-term strategy we're talking about. That's the globalist agenda that Bush is following. Second, they express concern about the military buildup that they fomented, but they do nothing substantive about it. Actually, I misnumbered. It's number three, is they wait or otherwise delay any preemptive action until it's too late. That is, until the country is too strong to strike, and then, or when war is suddenly upon us. And fifth, they accelerate or even provoke the war or providing agent provocateurs or other triggering events to help the enemy justify its aggression. But going back to number three, you know, the establishment media continues to pray the fall of communism upon us as its main rationale for saying that delaying confrontation with evil really works. Every time you bring up the fact that you've got to stop China, it says, no, 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 all we have to do is engage China, and we just keep working with it, just like Russia. Russia's communism will eventually fall apart, and they'll drop right into our hands, and we'll have peace. Well, that false reasoning has been extremely effective at silencing the critics and convincing Americans to be passive about the real axis of evil, that is, Russia and China. Sadly, it will only be contradicted, that argument, when Russia comes out of hiding and launches its preemptive strike on America with China as an ally, and then it will be too late to see the folly. The folly will be upon us.
Yeah, but, of course, the difficulty is that both China and Russia are in full military production for war. They're planning for war, and we're doing everything we can to finance them and to transfer the technology that can lead, of course, events to the destruction of a large segment of our society. And none of this really makes sense if you're looking at it logically, but if you're looking at it from the point of view that we're trying to draw them into an attack, then everything makes sense.
A lot of people really object to the concept of why would the... When they think only of the capitalist motivation, and this is one of the major flaws the critics of the Bush administration, and most of the critics, frankly, come from the left, and they see that this is merely corrupt capitalists trying to get wealthy in the world. So they cannot, with that rationale, see the philosophy that these people would bring an attack upon the United States and destroy the economic engine which makes them wealthy. They simply cannot conceive of that. And that's because the rationale is flawed. These are not simple capitalists trying to do this to increase their wealth. They already have as much wealth as any man can ever use. They already have as much power as anybody can use, but they're working for, I believe, a larger satanic agenda, which is to destroy liberty. And he always promises them in this great collusion with satanic or evil forces, they promise them immunity or the ability to come back and to enrich themselves in the aftermath of war. And that's exactly what happened in World War II. These people who lost all of their investment in Germany and in Europe after having built up Hitler got it all back during the Reconstruction years, and that's half of what Lend-Lease was all about. Was just like the Export-Import Bank today, when you give out all this money to these deadbeat nations around the world to sucker them into greater debt, but you also require that those companies make contracts with U.S. corporations, Caterpillar Tractor, Bechtel, to build nuclear power plants, and you finance it with American-backed loans to the Export-Import Bank. So what goes around comes around with these people.
And I think they can't really understand it unless they understand there is a spiritual component to this. There really are satanic forces in the world. Those satanic forces want to plunge us into World War III, and these things are prophesied in the scriptures. I don't think you can understand anything that's going on if you look at purely from a political or economic or cultural point of view. But if you look at it from a spiritual point of view, then all of these things begin to make sense.
It's amazing to me, Stan, in that line, how very few people, even Christians, believe in systematic evil anymore. They believe in an evil person here and there, but they just can't believe that governments and people would be in collusion and systematically evil. And that's what we're failing to see today.
Well, I think that's, of course, what we try here repeatedly to get people to understand. This is a spiritual battle. It's being fought on a political or economic battlefield, but if you ignore the spiritual, why, of course, you're going to completely lose sight of what we're up against. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief as we explore what's going on from the spiritual point of view, not from what's happening, but ask yourself why. How do you make any sense out of it? And if you're looking at it logically, there's no sense at all. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel, go right, pick the story right up again.
Well, I think we're ready to move on to Iraq now. I did quite a bit of research this week on what's going on in Iraq. There's a great deal of obscuration of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, we get the typical news story about a daily bombing in Iraq, but there's something else going on that's very, very serious, and that's the fomenting of civil war and the undermining of the Shiite majority's attempt to form a government. So I've entitled this update on Iraq, U.S. Won't Take No for an Answer. And as I say, this is one of the second story in my World Affairs brief coming out tomorrow. The U.S. has been putting, as you know, relentless pressure on the Shiite majority to withdraw the nomination of Prime Minister-designate Ibrahim al-Jafari. Thursday they succeeded, or today they succeeded, actually. Prime Minister al-Jafari agreed to allow Shiite legislators to vote again on who they would head the new government. Basically, he's bowing out. As I said before, the U.S. will push to install their own puppet in Baghdad, just as they have a puppet government in Afghanistan. Vice President Adil Abdul Mahdi is the U.S. choice, but he has much opposition within the alliance of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution. That's codenamed SIRA. Siri. Al-Jafari is out of the running now, since everybody knows the U.S. won't accept him. So the London Times has insider knowledge that the U.S. is planning another attack on insurgent neighborhoods after a suitable pro-American government's installed. I expect that to happen within the next couple of weeks, after, you know, they pick someone more amenable to the U.S. position. I'm convinced that much of this civil war has been provoked by purposeful U.S. military inaction in order to provide a suitable crisis to force al-Jafari's withdrawal. And I'm going to cover this in this particular world brief. I fear that if this is U.S. version of free elections, Iraqis are going to be increasingly bitter about Western-style democracy, which is the same thing they did by hiring Harvard University and their leftist political science people to develop the free market transition in Russia. It was only a half-baked job. It was purposely sabotaged, I believe, to make the Russians bitter about the free market and send them back into the arms of communism, which it has done. The free market is very, very unpopular in Russia among Russians, and so is America. So,
now hold that thought. We'll be back, Joel, in just a moment here as we bring our other stations right back on board here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel Skousen is simply pointing out that it would appear that we're simply getting rid of the man who the Iraqis elected to be the premier, and we're demanding new elections, and of course we want to install a puppet government in Iraq. But we have to do this under the guise of democracy, and just as we have a puppet and a man who used to work for UNICAL as the other premier, the duly elected premier of Afghanistan, so we're going to do the same thing in Iraq. And all this talk about democracy. I mean, the Iraqis are smart people. They can see that we are running everything over there. They can vote all they want to. They can all have the inked fingers and they can show them at everybody, but we determine who the leaders are going to be, and if they don't do what we want, they will simply be replaced or perhaps meet another fate. But pick up the story there.
Well, one of the problems with the interim government that they've had is getting control of the security situation. I mean, there are many problems. The U.S. has literally allowed so much corruption in the reconstruction contracts that nothing has been reconstructed of any note in Iraq. Yes, the military people, the Marines, have gone in and helped some orphanages and helped to rebuild a few hospitals, and there have been some good that has been done. But when it comes to these major reconstruction contracts, there's been so much graft and corruption going on that literally they've run out of money and nothing's working yet. Electricity isn't up, the sewage system isn't working, the telephone systems are not working completely yet. But worst of all is the security situation. The big problem in Iraq, and this is something that the U.S. has direct control over. They have direct control over the Ministry of Interior. They can, but what we're finding is, as Newsweek did a major story on this last week, saying that Iraqis don't know whom to trust. Men who say they're journalists could be insurgents. People dressed up as security officers could just be about anyone. Insurgents and militiamen have disguised themselves as soldiers, police, and probably fighters with rival militia groups. Some security units are fronts for specific military organizations, and it's widely believed that cops have banded together to form death squads. Now, the U.S. has control of this process. They could issue ID, for example, that would be that you wouldn't be able to copy, that you wouldn't be able, you know, to, for security forces to distinguish themselves, but they have not done that. I believe that they have purposely allowed what I'm going to describe to go on so as to create and foment civil war, to make it extremely difficult for the Shiite majority to govern. They may well allow this system to be cured if they get a puppet government in there as they begin to support it. But this is a real problem with these false identities and false uniforms. There is a corporation that has gone from nobody to huge in just a few months. It's called Facility Protection Service, FPS. Newsweek continues, even as American officials trumpet 2006 as the year of the police, a more problematic force with multiple agendas is emerging. The FPS, as it turns out, is a mutant security agency that has grown from 4,000 man group of night watchmen to an amorphous group that has almost 50,000 people in it. The Americans claim they don't oversee them either. We don't go anywhere near them, says Kim Teef, a U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad. Now, this is ludicrous. These people supposedly are supposed to be working for the Interior Ministry, which is under the direct control of the Americans still, who control this interim government.
Now is this are these Americans or these Arabs who are?
No, these are Arabs.
Okay.
Okay. And now, of course, these FPS people are suspected of committing at least some of the sectarian killings that have plagued the country in recent months. They have the same uniforms, weapons, and vehicles as the regular police. They're not controlled, claims by the Interior Ministry, they claim, or the Americans. No one seems to control them, but this is just ludicrous to think that they are. How do they get all the uniforms, the weapons, and the same vehicles as the police if they weren't given them by the Interior Ministry?
Now, are these some of these death squads that are going around? I mean, apparently, there are all sorts of atrocities being carried out, and, you know, Sunnis are being rounded up and, you know, hauled off, and then next thing you find 30 or 40 of them dead in a ditch. And are these the people responsible? Do we have any idea who's responsible for these death squads?
Well, everybody's claiming that on where these things were headquartered. A U.S. official involved in political and military plan in Baghdad, who didn't want to be identified to the Newsweek reporters, said the FPS has basically become a private army for the ministers. They have no accountability. And U.S. officials told Newsweek that the Ministry of Transportation, which is run by an openly anti-American ally of the Muqtada al-Sadr, employs large numbers of FPS soldiers. Thousands of them have been issued AK-47s and pistols, and they wear the same sky blue shirts and blue trousers as the Iraqi police. So, you know, the Interior Minister Jaber claims that he's not responsible for FPS, that it needs a radical solution. He suggested that the movement of security forces must be monitored. He wants new forgery-proof badges to be issued, but U.S. officials, while conceding the FPS is a big problem, suspect that Jaber is trying to deflect blame from the misdeeds of his own ministry and deflect blame on the U.S. I think there's truth going both ways, frankly, in this. I think the U.S. could step in and solve it. They can certainly lean on anybody in the government they want to. The ambassador certainly been doing that about getting rid of al-Jafri. But really, Dr. Stan, it truly has become a civil war in Iraq. The latest battleground has been the Adamiya, difficult to pronounce some of these words, Adamiya district of Baghdad. And this has become a very, very interesting battleground because apparently this is a stronghold for Sunnis, and there are insurgents in there. But this was an attack by Shiite militiamen dressed in Iraqi military and police uniforms. And they attacked any and all residents in this Sunni stronghold of the Adamiya district of Baghdad. And U.S. military people were observing all of this attack with their helicopters, and in fact even joined in with it. And here's their report. Over several weeks before the new clashes broke out in Adamiya, residents had been barricading the streets with tires and trunks, date palm trees to keep kidnappers and death squads away, which had been regularly preying on these neighborhoods. Of course, as you can see, if they're death squads, which they suspect are part of the Interior Ministry running in there and kidnapping people, and there's been some 20,000 kidnapped people in the last 2 years in Iraq, this is a major problem for innocents as well as anybody remotely connected with the insurgents. The clashes broke out on this previous Monday with a police raid on the area. That is, they came in with police uniforms. That means they had to be some way connected with the Interior Ministry. One of the witnesses said, "My family had thought a war had broken out because of so many heavy guns, mortars, and rocket-propelled grenades being used." So this was not just people going from house to house with AK-47s attacking. This was a major invasion with military-type weapons. Residents claimed the attack was clearly carried out by Shiite militia people. The sky even glowed red all through the night for the past 3 nights, and U.S. military helicopters were hovering above. So the Interior Ministry, of course, blames this on death squads that they don't control. And the people within the district say that they were recognizable as Shiite militia people. And, of course, the interim government is controlled by Shiite people. They named members of the Badr organization, the same wing of the Shiite Supreme Council, and the Mehdi army, which is, of course, connected to Muqtada al-Sadr. But we really don't know if the Interior Minister is telling the truth. Many think the attacks have been sanctioned by the Interior Ministry, as was the attack on the Samarra Golden Dome mosque, because witnesses viewed that Interior Ministry people were the ones guarding the place. They removed most of the guards, left five in place, and when the so-called attackers arrived in force of about 40 people, other Interior Ministry moved around to seal off the mosque so that nobody else could get to them while the bombers were in there rigging the place with explosives.
What you're really suggesting is that the Shias blew up their own mosque just to foment this civil war attitude, blame it on the Sunnis, and then you can keep the war going.
Yeah. And, you know, it's someone's putting them up to this.
Sure. But as long as there's violence there, then we can convince the American people we've got to stay on, because after all, if we pull out, there'd be a civil war. The civil war is already underway. And the longer we stay there, the longer it's going to last. And if we pull out, there's going to be civil war. If we stay, there's going to be civil war. We've got an impossible situation.
What's interesting here is the official U.S. story, as parroted by U.S. military reporting in Reuters. Insurgents mounted, they said, quote, a bold attack in the Alamiya district in Baghdad. They said about 50 insurgents mounted a brazen attack on Iraqi forces in Baghdad on Monday, prompting U.S. troops to provide support in a battle that lasted 7 hours. Well, this is just completely convoluted. It was the Shiites that attacked the Sunni neighborhood, not Sunni insurgents attacking the Shiite forces. And the U.S., according to witnesses, here's what happens. An Iraqi in Adamiya confirmed this immediately after the clashes ended by writing, U.S. troops also entered the neighborhood after the Shiites. At first, they only stood by and watched. Later on, they too fired at the locals who tried to repel the attacks. Other news outlets directly contradicted the statements of U.S. military spokesmen. Well, as I say, it wasn't the Sunnis that started this attack. And so one wonders, you know, when you look at this kind of a civil war, even though there are insurgents in the Adamiya district, this was clearly a bigger than just a search and destroy operation. This wasn't coming in and checking for weapons. This wasn't coming in and targeting insurgents. This was a rip-roaring attack coming into a neighborhood and essentially trying to do a Fallujah-style destruction of the neighborhood. And, of course, there's a lot of innocent people in there, and they tried to fight back. And the American military went to work to fight against the people who were defending themselves. Now, of course, the military spokesman also failed to mention on the same day that four gunmen attacked a Sunni mosque, killing a guard in the Adamiya district of the capital. Instead, we hear a report that U.S. Army officials said they suffered no casualties and planned to raid the homes in search of the gunmen. So we've got a real problem here, in that the U.S., even if it's innocent of directly starting the raid, and we simply don't know at this point who started this, they certainly took sides on behalf of the Shia militia when they went in to attack other civilians who were trying to defend themselves against the militia attack.
Well, it's such a tragic situation, and so many people are dying, those Shia and Sunni, and American forces are dying, and I don't see any ascent in sight, and President Bush keeps talking about pulling troops out, and then the next thing he says, well, our troops will be there until 2009, and the next president's going to have to decide what to do. And what you do is you end up with a lot of people sort of shrugging their shoulders and say, I can't figure what's going on. I thought we were going to pull out, and now we're talking about staying until 2009. And don't you think a lot of this is just designed to confuse the American people?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the mere size of the Baghdad embassy there, we're talking about a 127-acre embassy with houses, gymnasiums, complete facilities, four major buildings, underground tunnel. I mean, they're not... I mean, this is a major... The largest embassy in the world is being in Baghdad. We're not leaving this country anytime soon. Not at all.
I don't know why anybody would think we would leave. After all, we still are occupying Germany 60 years after the Second World War, occupying Japan 60 years after the Second World War, occupying South Korea 50 years after the war there ended. Why would anybody think we're going to bring our troops home, at any time from there? We have to have an excuse, though, because if there was peace in both Afghanistan and Iraq, why then, how could we justify remaining there? How would you convince the American people we were justified in continuing keeping our troops in place?
Well, certainly there will be some political withdrawal of some troops, but it will only be for a show. And once you start that withdrawal, everyone's going to say, oh, well, we're starting to succeed in Iraq. And it will pacify them. The American public are very easily pacified.
I can remember, of course, Bill Clinton saying that our troops would be home from Bosnia by November. He just didn't specify which November.
And they're still there.
Right.
Well, you know, even the U.S. is covering for the failure in that massive attack in Fallujah. Essentially, the U.S. military with air power flattened this entire city. But the truth is there's an open wound there in Fallujah, and the fighting is still going on there. Recently, this Monday, three Iraqi civilians were killed there by U.S. troops, along with 10 wounded in the Jebail district of the city. Of the 10 wounded, three were women and two were children. In fact, fierce fighting in Fallujah has been ongoing since the few months after the November 2004 U.S. attack, which destroyed most of the buildings and left homeless 350,000 people. But it's interesting, Stan, that the U.S. military doesn't want people to see that American soldiers are still dying there on a daily basis. Rather than calling it Fallujah, where soldiers die, they prefer a sort of Bermuda Triangle approach and say Anbar Province. And I think you've heard this. We say so many Marines were killed in Anbar Province today. But if you watch to where these death reports are coming from, they're coming from Camp Fallujah, the military camp right outside the city, which is occupied by the Marines. Now, in one of the reports in Newsweek, Scott Johnson did give a list of about a dozen Marines who were killed in Anbar Province. The reports all came out of Camp Fallujah. He said this is hardly a complete list of soldiers killed in Fallujah, and some of the aforementioned may not even actually have been killed inside the city. But it's obvious, he says, that military announcements of the deaths of soldiers in other places mention the specific name of the city, whether they occur in Samarra or Tal Afar, or elsewhere, but the U.S. military never admits when someone is killed in the city of Fallujah. They simply say Anbar Province. It's obvious that they have been given orders to make sure that the Americans believe and continue to believe that Fallujah is a successful operation, and it hasn't been a success. Resistance in Fallujah is still very active, and all the destruction to the city by the American soldiers did not succeed in stopping that. The city, as you know, was totally destroyed in the November attack and is still surrounded and closed to anyone other than citizens of the city. So, you know, what's going on now is that Americans are trying to conceal their failure by not letting anybody in. Reporters aren't allowed in still. There are at least five explosions a day and more than one clash between resistance fighters and U.S. soldiers.
What a tragedy, and of course, American lives continue to be lost, and Iraqi women and children, and everybody says, oh, well, that's just sort of goes along with war, you know, that's just what do they call it?
Collateral damage.
Yeah,
very sad.
And yet, of course, you know, how would you feel if you were a Muslim living over there? How would you feel about America? How would you feel about Christianity? And I think our government is doing everything they can to inflame the Muslims of the world, and to turn them not only against America but against Christianity and all this love and idealism they talk about, but you know, actions speak a lot louder than words, and they know that we did not go in there simply because we thought Saddam had weapons of mass destruction.
I completely agree, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Joe, let's get your telephone number. Let's get your website out. People will know how to get in touch with you.
Yes, to read more about the World Affairs Brief and my ongoing news service, you can go to www.worldaffairsbrief.com. All one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And there you'll get a rundown of all the news stories. I have two very fine researchers that post the day's top news on that website. I analyze that news every Friday. There's a modest subscription for my analysis that comes out by email every Friday. Encourage people to sign up for that they can get the same kind of analysis that we've been talking about today on your show, Dr. Stan.
Well, I certainly recommend anybody go there. And certainly, it's worldaffairsbrief.com. I go there first thing in the morning after I get my emails just to find out what's going on, and I can get the information I'm not going to get from the controlled media. So we've got about 2 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, let me just bring out one short, quick story, which is very interesting, is that the U.S. continues to find new ways to funnel money into defense contractors in secret ways. The Washington Post even reported this, that the Army canceled plans for its radar-evading Comanche helicopter after producing two prototypes, and then granted Sikorsky Aircraft Corporation, who ran the program, approximately the last 4 years, $200 million in award fees. Now, here they are over budget by $3.5 billion, 3 years behind schedule, and they get $200 million in award fees. Now, these award fees, I believe, are more of the $300 toilet seat type payments that go to contractors. The government isn't stupid. They don't pay $300 for a toilet seat without oversight. They give those kinds of prices to contractors because that's how they hide black budget payments, that is, payments for projects that are ongoing. Frankly, I don't believe the Comanche helicopter has been canceled. It's going to be canceled as far as delivered to the Army, but it's certainly too valuable, this nearly silent black-painted helicopter, for military black ops and CIA use. I'm sure that with these extra funds that are being funneled to Sikorsky, that they will, in fact, build a secret squadron of those four black operations.
Okay, well, we're out of time, and I appreciate that, and I recommend to all of our listeners, get the World Affairs Brief. Read it every week as I do, and, of course, you'll learn so much and get so much insight into the information you're not going to get from the controlled media. Joel Skousen, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless you. All right. Well, our guest, of course, has been Joel Skousen from the World Affairs Brief, and certainly I always enjoy his commentary. I hope that you do as well. And I think it's vitally important that people understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day by radio and 4 hours a day on shortwave, and we have a Saturday program as well, but we're trying to get people to think and to understand what's really going on behind the scenes. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, call us at that same number. We'll be glad to send them to you. Or you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and read them on a regular basis. Or you could subscribe to the newsletter or join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. I do want to mention that I'm going to be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference, which is going to be held on the 27th and 28th of May of this year. It's going to be held over in Santa Clara, just north of San Jose, at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. and if you'd like more information about what's going to be going on, of course, Jim Mars will be there, John DeCamp of the Franklin Cover-Up, Will Thomas, who's written extensively about Gulf War illness, I'll be speaking, Ted Gunderson, Raylan Allen, Clay Douglas. Well, I think you'll find it a fascinating thing. Program. You can look at their website at conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracycon.com, or call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. I think you'll be fascinated. We'll have a booth there. There'll be a number of booths. You'll see people from all parts of the political spectrum. Some people I would disagree with. Some people who would disagree with me. But you'll see an overview of what's going on. And you'll even see some of the people there who come from the dark side that we oppose so adamantly. And so we hope many of you, if you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will make it a point to get it, because it'll introduce you to this spiritual aspect of what's going on today, and to the secret societies which are fostered by the secret society, by these demonic, truly demonic forces. And certainly we have a three-pamphlet set called The Occult Hierarchy. There is an occult hierarchy that rules the world, operates from behind the scenes, and we're told in the scriptures, for we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to suggest that that's absolutely true. There truly is spiritual wickedness at the highest levels of our society today. And then, of course, we certainly, if you'd like to know more about that three-pamphlet set, The Occult Hierarchy, or the other material we have, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't seen my video, it's entitled World Revolution. It's a talk we give going into the background of the World Revolution, based upon a book written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress. His book is called Fire in the Minds of Men. If you read President Bush's second inaugural speech, he'll talk about the fire in the minds of men, how we've lit this fire in the minds of men. And, of course, he's referring to a book written by Dostoevsky called The Possessed. It is the story of the world revolution, and of course we're acting out the world revolution now as we move to bring dictatorship to nations throughout the world, of course under the guise of democracy, and we move towards the destruction of freedom here in America. So pray for America, pray for revival, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, until, well, we'll be back and till we're together again. May the Lord be with you. eyes forever. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Tim Keller, who's from Frontline Fellowship and Peter Hammond's organization over in Africa. And Tim is an American who felt that there was work to be done, God's work to be done, and went over to Africa in 1998. He's been there ever since then, working with Peter and going out all over Africa, bringing the word of the Lord to the people there and helping to disciple the ministers and the people, because they may be Christians, but they really don't understand Christianity, and they need to learn and grow in their faith. So without further ado, Tim Keller, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure, and of course we've talked to Tim a couple of times before about the things that are going on in Africa. What motivated you to leave the comfort of the United States and go over there to the very dangerous existence that there is there today?
I think the bottom line for my motivation for doing the Lord's work in Africa is simply that I love the Lord. I think missionary work is just simply an extension of our relationship with God, and when you love someone, you want to do what pleases them, and I know that serving the Lord in Africa pleases him, and that's exactly what I set out to do.
Well, I admire you for going. I wish I was young enough to come over and help you and Peter, but for the time being, well, you're just going to have our prayers and certainly our financial help. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in South Africa itself, because you live in South Africa. Now, when I lived there in the mid-1970s, well, it was a very prosperous country. The living standards of the black were rising. Certainly, if you were a black man, you could get a job if you wanted to. Yes, there were certainly discrimination. It was simply part and parcel of the civilization that had been there for a long time, but it was gradually changing, and certainly they were beginning to integrate sports, they beginning to integrate neighborhoods, beginning to integrate schools, and they would have eventually done away with all racial discrimination, the apartheid system. That was the plan. And certainly they did not have any racial discrimination in Rhodesia. Every man there could vote if he had a certain amount of education, black or white. And they had prosperous societies in both Rhodesia and Africa. But there were those in the American State Department who were intent upon changing that. What's happened in South Africa since why they brought the Marxist government to power? Because the ANC has always been Marxist, and once again we've created one of the best enemies money could buy. What's happened in South Africa since Nelson Mandela and now his successor Mbeki have come to power?
It's interesting because, you know, the media has successfully propped up Nelson Mandela as being kind of like this great hero, this wonderful saint of peace, when the whole time, the reason why he was in jail was because he was involved in terrorist activities, he was involved in necklacing people, where that's where they take tires and they stack them on top of the person and set the tires on fire and burn people alive. He was involved in these various activities, bombings, and that sort of thing.
And he refused to renounce his terrorist activities. And we were supporting this man who was a lifelong terrorist. But it's amazing, you know, when you control the media, how you can make even the most brutal of people appear to be a sort of a grandfatherly figure. And of course, when he was inaugurated, there was Hillary Clinton, and there was Gaddafi of Libya, and there was, of course, Fidel Castro, all celebrating a Marxist coming to power in South Africa with the full support with the full support of the American State Department.
Well,
go ahead, right ahead, Kim. Go ahead.
During the 70s and 80s, the ANC was very much the enemy of the state. They were the communists trying to overthrow the government. and they were fighting them even militarily, and they were involved in a lot of terrorist activities. But since Mandela's release, the unbanning of the ANC, now the ANC has come to power. And the first thing that Mandela does is he legalizes abortion, he legalizes pornography, you know, he scraps the in humble submission to Almighty God out of the Constitution, so he secularizes the Constitution. The Constitution has become very favorable towards homosexual rights, which now has led to the legalization of homosexual marriages in South Africa. And all this was done soon after he came to power. South Africa has one of the most liberal constitutions in the world, and the people, the ANC, is very communistic in its ideals. They're trying to implement a more state-controlled system there. They're doing it fairly slowly. There's a lot of division within the party as to how fast they should be doing it or not doing it, but they're fairly united as to what they want to accomplish, and what they want to accomplish is simply what you see in happening in Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe right now is in complete ruins.
And that's really because they've nationalized the farms. They've taken them away forcibly from the white people. Most of the white people have had to flee, and of course they've gone into Zambia. They've gone into Mozambique. They've gone into Nigeria, where they've been welcomed. In fact, in Mozambique, the Mozambique government gave the white farmers large plots of land so that they would grow food. They went into Zambia and of course bought land. They've been given land in Nigeria by the Nigerian government because everybody recognizes that they would be an asset to the country, except in their own native land of Zimbabwe, where, of course, they have taken their farms away from them, and, of course, what they've done is impoverished the blacks there. I mean, before, the blacks, you know, they had homes, they had security, they had money, they had an opportunity for education and to get ahead, and they've destroyed all of that. They've created a one-party system with the full support of communist China, which is backed, of course, by the United States, and as a direct product there, why many of these people are living really in poverty and on the verge of starvation. Isn't that true, Tim?
Well, in Zimbabwe, that's certainly the case. There's actually quite a lot of widespread starvation taking place there. And the starvation is primarily government instigated. The party supporters are not starving. The opposition is starving. And any relief going into Zimbabwe there's attempts to channel it to only party supporters.
Now, that's exactly as it is in North Korea as well. All the food goes to the communists and nothing to the anti-communists. Hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Tim Keller. Tim, go ahead. And just simply talking about the deplorable situation in Zimbabwe and Africa, where we brought the communist Mugabe to power, a lifelong Maoist who'd been trained in communist China. We brought him to power. He, of course, has the full support of communist China today, and they have their communist Chinese agents in this tragic country. The people are starving. There is absolutely no freedom of the press. There's no freedom of the judiciary. Everything is tyranny, and you can thank Henry Kissinger and the American State Department for lying to the Rhodesian people and getting them to give up their freedom with the America's guarantee that if things ever got bad, we would be there to get them out of it. And I know Peter Hammond talks about having heard Henry Kissinger on the radio in Zimbabwe promising the people there America would always keep its promise. And Henry Kissinger's promise and $2 to buy a cup of coffee almost anywhere in the world today. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, well, in Zimbabwe, like I said, the situation there is very grim. The currency has been incredibly inflated. I mean, back in 98 when I first started working there, 60 Zim dollars is what it took to buy one U.S. dollar. And even earlier in the 70s, one Rhodesian dollar could buy you three U.S. dollars. So already there was a dramatic inflation. But since 1998, I was there in Zimbabwe just recently, early this year, and one U.S. dollar could buy you between 100 and 180,000 Zim dollars, depending on who you would exchange with, how bad they needed the money versus how bad you wanted the money. And that kind of inflation has just led to all kinds of economic problems. Anybody that could leave the country has left the country, and people that want to leave the country can't. They can't get passports. They can't get permits to leave the country. And a lot of the people that are stuck there, particularly among the white population, are your pensioners. And these pensioners are having a very hard time I know one gentleman who had he was a professor in a university for like 30 years, and his pension is worth about $4 a month.
$4 a month. Of course, remember that the stability of a currency, is necessary for the stability of a society. You can't have a stable society without a stable currency. They've destroyed the value of the currency there, just as they are destroying the value of the currency here in the United States. In fact, just within the last 2 days, I read an article where the World Bank said they're just going to have to decrease the value of the American dollar to begin to get financial stability throughout the rest of the world. So we're going to lose the value of our currency. I don't think it'll be quite as rapidly as in Rhodesia. But, they have totally destroyed the value of the savings and the wealth of all of the people who put their faith into the Rhodesian currency. So what about, of course, religious freedom there? What about freedom in the ability to speak out against the government?
Well, you're allowed to exercise a freedom of religion in terms of worship and that as long as you remain quiet. And I think that's kind of common in many communist countries is they say, oh yeah, there's freedom of religion as long as you don't say anything against the government. I mean, in other words, you can sit in your closet and you can pray, but don't bring the word of God to bear on our government or on any of our policies. And that's what it is in Zimbabwe. And if you dare speak out against the government in Zimbabwe, you will have guys knocking on your door and they will beat the tar out of you.
Well, now, of course, at one time, the church could have spoken out. The church could have done something about the descending tyranny. But what did the church do? I mean, did the ministers speak out against what was going on, or did they hold their peace, feeling that their only obligation was to win souls?
You know, this is the thing. The church has essentially withdrawn itself from the society, saying, you know, we can't get involved in politics. Politics is dirty. Leave it for the pagans, and so the pagans have just taken it over. And when the church had the opportunity to say something, bring the word of God to bear on the political situation, they didn't do it, and now they can't say anything without facing serious consequences. Even people that want to pray, they have meetings in churches where they say, we want to pray for our government. And when the government hears about that, they send people, they arrest the pastors, throw them in jail, they beat people up, and it gets real messy.
Well, what is a Frontline Fellowship doing in Rhodesia at the present time, or in Zimbabwe?
Well, in Zimbabwe, you know, some of these pensioners and people have to make a choice that you and I don't have to make. Some of these older people, they have to decide, do I take my medication today, or do I eat? And we've been having to smuggle food into Zimbabwe, which has been difficult at times and is a high risk. We could very easily ourselves get locked up and face serious consequences if we got caught. But we smuggle food into the country because we care, we love these people, we want to make sure that they have what they need to survive. And although we're not able to do it on a very large scale, we can at least do it something. And so we're doing our best to try to do that. Like I say, it is done at very high risk.
All right, fine. And now, of course, then you also are working in Zambia, which is immediately north of that. And Zambia, of course, was a Marxist dictatorship for many years under Kenneth Kaunda. And then, of course, he had an election there. I don't think Kenneth Kaunda ever thought that he would be voted out of office, but he was. And so what's happened since Kenneth Kaunda? The lifelong Marxist was voted out of office.
Well, to follow him, there was a President Chiluba who declared Zambia to be a Christian nation and was Christian in many ways himself initially. And Zambia saw a lot of great reforms. What Kahuna did to the economy, he absolutely destroyed it. He nationalized the mines, he nationalized the farms, and just ran the economy to the ground. Chiluba came back with a lot more free market policies, trying to solicit external support and these kinds of things, and things have changed quite dramatically. However, Chiluba has himself at a later stage become very corrupt, and there was a lot of corruption there. They've had another election. The current president now seems to be trying to fight corruption, and it is even bringing the former president up on charges of corruption. So it looks like which sets a precedence for future freedoms. And there's future ministers of the state have to now be accountable at least to the courts in terms of their conduct and their corrupt activities. So there's a lot of great things happening in terms of that. There's widespread evangelism in Zambia. There's a thoroughly Christian population who are looking to be evangelistic even beyond their borders and being missionary-minded to Congo, to Zimbabwe, to Mozambique, to Angola. So the church is quite thriving well in Zambia. The infrastructure in Zambia is being restored quite well now. The roads used to be horrific. You couldn't drive very far at all without hitting some serious potholes, and now they've smoothed many of the main highways out, which it helps the economy quite dramatically after that.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly am glad things are going fairly well there. Now, do you know anything at all about Mozambique? Because, of course, Mozambique went through a terrible civil war, and then eventually, of course, the Marxists were defeated, and the anti-communists came to power, and they invited the whites to come in from Rhodesia to set up farms there so that they could feed their own people. And I understand that Mozambique has made an amazing turnaround.
Mozambique has. In fact, Frontline Fellowship started its work in Mozambique back in 1982 during the war. Our work there was to smuggle Bibles into the country because very few people had Bibles. It was a war zone. The church in South Africa wasn't interested in going into Mozambique because of the conflict. And our director felt, no, it's our Christian duty to help these people. So he went in it on a motorbike with very little resources, and that's how our mission got going. And Mozambique, since then, the war has stopped. A lot more missionaries have gone into Mozambique, so there's a lot of missionary activity there now, and the infrastructure is being improved, the economy is being improved, and things are going fairly well. There is still quite a lot of corruption and things like that, but all that is it's far less than what it used to be. And I think Mozambique is a very ripe field for people that are interested in doing missions. I would definitely recommend Mozambique.
All right, fine. Well, of course, then, what about Malawi? I mean, Malawi, of course, is one of those little countries in South Africa. You got Lesotho, you got Swaziland, Malawi. Malawi has a king, doesn't it?
It's
got a premier there.
They have a president. And
I guess Swaziland has the king and Lesotho has a king. But
that's right.
All right, but Malawi then has a president. Okay, go ahead. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Malawi? Because you were actually invited to go in there, weren't you?
Malawi has been a fairly peaceful country, and because of that, it's not necessarily been a frontline fellowship mission field. And because our mission tries to specialize in conflict areas where the church is being persecuted, and we try to help the most needy in that. But Malawi kind of opened up when we got a call from the special assistant to the president on religious affairs. He's actually the president of he's a pastor of the president's church, the current president. And he invited us to come and do workshops and things with the pastors there to teach them about Islam, because one of the greatest threats in Malawi now is Islam. It's growing quite rapidly. The former president used to be Muslim, and the current president's making a lot of reforms that has dramatically upset the Muslims. For example, he shut down the Libyan embassy. He opened up the Israeli embassy. He's gotten rid of all the Muslims out of the national intelligence. He's replaced them with Israelis, and this has really upset those in politics who are Muslims, and they've even attempted to assassinate him. So he's had a rough road, and he's gone and formed his own party now, and there's a lot of changes taking place now.
All right, fine. Well, is the church growing in Malawi?
I believe so, but in Malawi it's sometimes difficult to say, because, you know, when you work in Africa, you get genuine Christians. But then you get a lot of people that will say they're Christian because they want to solicit some kind of donors or outside support. And that's kind of hard to wade through sometimes.
Well, of course, I think the interesting thing is that the Muslims, the radical, no, these are not simply Muslims, this is the radical form of Islam, is taking a hold. It's there in Malawi, it's certainly in South Africa, where Muslims, radical Muslims, make only a very small percentage, and yet they're funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia, who are financing this whole radical worldwide Muslim revolution with the full support of our own government. I mean, they're working in Nigeria, whipping up discord, they're working in South Africa. Are they effective in their effort to create problems in South Africa, the Saudis I'm talking about?
At least the money coming from Saudi Arabia has been fairly effective. The Muslims have taken over a lot of businesses in South Africa. They've taken up a lot of political positions within the government and have a tremendous influence in South Africa, even though they make up a very small percentage. The Muslims in Malawi, they set up mosques from one end to the other. You can't drive hardly to a single village without seeing a mosque.
We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, I guess this evening, Tim Keller, we're talking about what's happening in South Africa, and certainly we're talking about the influence of the Saudi Arabia funding. Saudi is funding this whole world radical Islamic movement, you know, and of course, Al-Qaeda was funded by them, as was the Taliban, and the Saudis are funding certainly the insurgents in Iraq, and they're funding, you know, the radical Islamic movement in the United States and all throughout Africa, and yet we're doing everything we can to build up Saudi Arabia. Saudi doesn't make much sense, does it?
It does if you're in the oil business.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, now what about the influence then of the Islamic movement in the northern part of Africa? What about their influence in the Sudan? And certainly, is the government of the Sudan been taken over by this radical form of Islam, or is it the more conventional, more moderate form of Islam?
It's hard to distinguish between conventional and radical Islam because consistent Islam is radical, what we consider radical Islam. Inconsistent Islam is what you consider conventional or more the peaceful types. They're actually being inconsistent with their faith. And Islam has a very deliberate strategy in taking countries over. They start with their very small percentages, taking over businesses, giving out welfare, soliciting people into the Islam. They take a very peaceful approach. As they increase in numbers, we see things like what are happening in France where they start with their belligerence, they start with the riots, they start creating instability and these kinds of things. And then when Islam actually takes a country over, they initiate Sharia law. And where that, under Sharia law, there is total religious persecution for anything except for Islam. If you're not a Muslim, you're going to pay heavy taxes. If you're a Muslim and you leave to join Christianity, they're going to put you to death. There's horrible persecution. In Sudan, they've borne tremendous amounts of persecution. Everything from slavery to landmines in the crop fields so that they go and harvest the crops to step on a landmine. They bomb the schools, they bomb the hospitals, they bomb the churches. And over 2 million have died in Sudan since during the duration of the war, and just horrendous casualties. And since then, though, there's been a peace agreement that has been signed, and this peace agreement has allowed for the South to have some at least governance of its own in the meantime. They're looking at having a referendum in about 5 years' time where they can decide if they want to stay united to the North or secede to form an independent nation. And there's a conservative effort by the Muslims to try to Islamicize the South in the meantime to get them to vote to stay a united country because there's a lot of resources in the South. So there's a tremendous amount of conflict that has taken place. They have a peace right now, but we need to be praying for Sudan because there's a lot of secular influence going in there now, and they're going to be facing this referendum that could change the course of the whole future of the country. So,
are they going to have a referendum on whether they want to create a separate country? Is that it?
That's right. And to be honest, I think that's exactly what they need. The South are blacks, they're Christians, they're very different than their Arab Muslims in the North. And I just don't see the two as being compatible.
Well, I certainly hope, of course, that they can have their own country. They don't have a lot of natural resources, but they have a lot of courage, and they were willing to fight. They've had to fight as Christians. They've had to fight for their existence. I wonder if the Christians in America would ever be willing to fight for their freedom and their existence. We'll be back in just a moment with Tim Keller of Frontline Fellowship. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Tim Keller, and of course we're talking about what's going on in Africa, and of course he spent a great deal of time over there in the Sudan, and basically my understanding is they have a peace agreement between the North and the South. At least the incessant bombing of the schools and of the hospitals has been called off, and at least is there some semblance of peace there? What's going on in the Nuba Mountains and in the southern part of the Sudan?
Well, the southern part of the Sudan and the Nuba Mountains has in the past faced tremendous amounts of persecution, but recently with the peace treaty, things have calmed down quite dramatically. There are a lot of missions agencies and relief agencies looking to move into the south and people that want to help go and build up the infrastructure and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of positive changes taking place. There's still a remnant of conflict, though, because because, mind you, you have a whole generation of people now that have no education. Essentially, during the war, people were not being educated hardly at all. And so they've got a lot of work to do there. They also have a lot of tribal conflicts. You have a whole generation of people who know nothing but fighting. And now that they aren't fighting people in the north, some of the different tribes are looking at other tribes and saying, hey, you know, I want what you have. So there's just some tribal conflicts that are taking place still that we hope to see a resolution in the near future.
Well, do you have any good strong leaders there that people can rally behind from all the various tribal groups?
Well, the current deputy president of Sudan, who is the former deputy chairman of the South Movement, is seeking and has done a fairly good job at uniting the South. He's been able to work with the various forces to prevent a lot of the tribal conflicts from continuing and that sort of thing. And so, and he's also looking to win the referendum comes to try to secede from the North. And so he's got a strong position there. So he's actually the kind of guy that is really needed to lead the South in the right direction.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, so at least we have an element of stability there in the South. Now, what about in the West, or the conflict in Darfur? We hear so much about that here in the United States, and we're hearing that hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered. Are those figures realistic? Are they simply focusing our attention on this? Is this a real important issue, or is this sort of a non-issue?
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of people try to talk about Islam as being like a black man's religion. That's how I've heard it promoted here in the United States, which I find fascinating, because Islam has dominated the slave trade in the last couple of centuries, or last 1400 centuries. They're still involved in it. So, but what you have in the Darfur region is you have Arab Muslims fighting black Muslims, because the black Muslims feel the Arab Muslims are treating them as second-class Muslims. So there's that conflict going on, and to be honest, I look at it as, okay, the UN needs more funding, so they're focusing on another crisis. They often have been ignoring, or at least the media has been ignoring, the whole conflict in the South that has been taking place over the last 20-some years. And now with the recent upflare of this conflict with these Muslims, they've now focused in on that, which I find interesting. Well, it's been a lesson for me in terms of what the media pays attention to and what it doesn't. I think on a worldwide scale, we see the international wiring services and stuff. When it comes to the persecution of Christians, when it comes to Christianity at all, it's either ignored or it's put in a bad light. And so, in the case of
all right, fine. Well, of course, you know, it's a tragic situation in that part of the world. Our guest, of course, is Tim Keller from Frontline Fellowship, and this is Peter Hammond's organization operating out of Cape Town. And yet, of course, they have, you know, ministries in many of the countries of Africa, usually the most war-torn. And then you also have ministries in Eastern Europe, don't you?
Well, our sister mission, ITMI, which is stationed out of Tempe, has been ministering for, I think, the past 50 years, close to that, or at least the past 20 years under Bill Bathman. Behind the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe, he used to smuggle Bibles back there when days were dark and the Berlin Wall was still up. And nowadays, ITMI is looking to try to help Eastern Europe try to rebuild itself, at least the church, and get its feet back on the ground, because the church has suffered tremendously during the communist era there.
But of course, is there really much in the way of a Protestant church in Eastern Europe? I thought it was predominantly Catholic or Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox. But we're going to be back here in just a moment with Tim Keller. When we get back, we'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Our brothers and sisters are suffering throughout the world. They need our help. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Tim Keller from Frontline Fellowship. And when we get back in just a moment, Barb, we're going to have Tim tell you how to get hold of his ministry and what you perhaps can do to help them in their effort as they carry out God's work in Africa. Do you think that the Christian church is making inroads? Do you think that the influence of Christianity is increasing there?
I think very much so, and quite dramatically. I look at Africa as a whole, and working there is very difficult. The physical challenges are very tough. You've got to eat food that you wouldn't even want to smell. You've got to travel in some very harsh conditions. You've got to sometimes be in very insecure circumstances. But when you get over all the physical challenges of working in Africa, spiritually, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, I've done evangelism here in the States, and I've done work here, and you'll preach till your lips are blue, and the people will say, "Oh, that's good for you," and leave. In Africa, when you preach, everything's yes and amen. They respond very well to God's word, and they're very spiritually oriented. And I see a rapid growth in the church and a lot of potential for Africa. So that's really why my heart's there and why I still do what I do there.
Well, of course, I know, too. I love Africa, and I love the African people. And they really are warm and very appreciative for everything you do for them. What about the influence of the AIDS epidemic? What impact is AIDS having on Africa today?
AIDS is literally just killing the continent, and it's hitting people in their prime years, leaving an economic disaster behind. I mean, even in countries like Zambia in the mining region, you have, if you go to the graveyard, what you'll notice particularly strange about it is not that there's so many graves, and there's a lot, but the fact that the graves are unmaintained. In African culture, they practically worship the dead, and so when it comes to a dead relative, they always are maintaining the grave. But it's gotten to the point now where people are dying so fast and so regularly that they can't even maintain the graves of those people who have gone on to eternity. So, and in South Africa, I've heard of people who have gone to a funeral on a Saturday, and there's like 200 other funerals going on the same day.
And I think the average American really has no grasp of really what's happening, the terrible tragedy of the epidemic. And we have people here in America who say there is no AIDS epidemic. We have an organized effort to convince people there is no AIDS epidemic. And, of course, we've lost 500,000 people in America, another 1 million infected. But in Africa, things are really bad.
Yeah, the percentages in Africa far, far exceed what you find in any Western country.
We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Tim Keller. And Tim is with Frontline Fellowship. Tim, would you like to give your website, your telephone number? How can people get in touch with your mission, which, of course, is In Touch Ministries, but how can they get in touch with your ministry?
Okay, well, we have our sister mission here in Tempe, Arizona. And if they want to contact us, I think the best thing to do is to go to the website. And the website is www.intouchmission.org. That's www.intouchmission.org. And if you're within Arizona and want to give us a call, you can dial 480-968-4100. That is 410-968-4100. Alternatively, if you're not in Arizona, you can dial 888-918-4100. And if you want to be informed about what we do as Frontline Fellowship, go to our website at www.frontline.org.za. That's www.frontline.org.za. And there you can download articles, you can hear about some of our projects, hear about some of the things that we're doing so that you can be more informed, that you can be praying for us. And if you want to help us accomplish some of these things, you can do so as well.
And I want to recommend this ministry to you. Barbara and I, my wife and I, do support Frontline Ministries. We think that their effort really is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and perhaps only we can only help them financially and with our prayers, but we hope that you will give that serious consideration as well. The harvest is there. Certainly, disease is sweeping Africa. AIDS is one of the great tragedies of our modern times, and we're not doing anything we to stop it. Most people don't know that the epidemic in Africa is being monitored by the U.S. Commerce Department, and we get their regular reports. It's the U.S. Census Bureau that goes down to actually see what a great job we're doing in Africa with our program there. You can go to a place like Botswana, where the latest figures show that 46%. Of women who are pregnant, who come in to be tested for HIV, 46% are HIV infected. Now, that is the greatest public health tragedy of all time, the greatest public health failure, or the most successful genocidal policy in record. So the question is, if it's a public health failure, you would expect to change the approach, wouldn't you? But they're not. They're maintaining the same approach. And you have to ask then, what is the real agenda of the World Health Organization and all the money that you're putting out to help in this fight on AIDS? And I will tell you that in Uganda, where the Christi refuse to go along as much as they can with the World Health Organization, where they stress abstinence and certainly purity and sexual purity and abstinence before marriage, why, of course, the incidence of HIV disease has dropped dramatically. And, of course, in the countries that are following the advice of the World Health Organization and U.S. officials, why the disease is spreading with frightening intensity. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have a question for Tim, because he's on the front lines of this battle to bring the Lord's message, the message of Christianity to people throughout the world. Now, do you still have a ministry going into Angola? I know in the past you did.
We haven't so much anymore. Angola right now has opened its borders. There are a lot of missionaries going in there, and so a lot of our work there has been diminished. We do have good friends of ours that do work in Angola, and we try to support them wherever we can as well. But we don't directly work there anymore.
All right. Of course, when the Civil War was going on, and they had to actually smuggle in both medical supplies and Bibles, InTouch was going in there. And then, of course, apparently now it is much more open than it was before. And it really, under the control of the Marxists, fully supported by your government and by Chevron Oil Company, which has funded the communists there and even funded the communist troops that Fidel Castro sent over. Why would the American government allow the funding of the communist troops in Angola? Well, we might ask why we brought Marxists to power in Southwest Africa and in South Africa and in Zimbabwe, but the answer sometimes is rather disquieting to consider. Well, you know, what about the prosperity of South Africa? Is the economy of South Africa doing fairly well?
It's somewhat stable at the moment. I think it's got a rough road ahead. There's concerted efforts to want to do land reform in South Africa, just like Zimbabwe. And, even the vice president was quoted as saying that, you know, we can learn a lot from Zimbabwe. We should actually get some of them down here to teach us how we can do land reform here. And when she said that, there was no rebuke from anybody in her party. There was just the silence. And it honestly, when things like that are said, foreign investors run as fast as they can. And I'm afraid that if they're wanting to in any way model the property issues of Zimbabwe in South Africa, they're going to have a very bumpy road ahead.
One of our listeners in Nizhna, do you know where Nizhna is?
Nizhna, yes, I've been there.
All right, well, we used to have a farm there in Nizhna, but you know, one of our listeners in Nizhna just sent us a picture, of the beautiful lagoon and the Nizhna heads and the mountains in behind where our farm was. And it really is such a beautiful spot, and it's such a tragedy to think of the things that are befalling. We actually had elephants on our farm there, if you can imagine that. They were the Nizhna elephants, little bands of them roam around. Right now we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz, and again our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Good, Stan. I don't know if you all touched on this or not already, but in light of the agendas of governments, especially in Africa, to either decimate or annihilate the black man altogether, what census reports might there be, or census statistics, or whatever, that would show a likely decline in the population of the black race.
I don't know. Do you know anything about the population statistics there, Mike? Tim?
There are different sites that you can get statistics from. I don't know of them offhand, so I can't give you specific details. But I know if you go online that I'm sure the UN has quite a lot of statistics and things like that.
Well, Mike, I do have the statistics on the incidence of HIV disease and its impact. And in many of the countries, the average life expectancy, I think in Botswana, it's something like 36 years. And in several of the countries, it was up around 65 was the life expectancy. Now the life expectancy of the black man will be down to 36 years. So, it is having a tremendous effect, but I don't have those figures in my statistics. All I have are the AIDS statistics, since that was one of my concerns. And when you see what they're doing with a public health policy to kill off the population, and you have to ask, where is the outcry from the church in America and from our Christian leaders?
Well, I have to say that every time I see reports reflecting the statistics you just described, I just can't help but imagine that this high incidence of HIV infection can't possibly be solely from sexual promiscuity or passing through breastfeeding, etc. It just seems too far out that it would be spread so far and wide. It just seems like it's actually being perpetrated in probably more direct ways on the people there.
Well, thank you so much. Anything else you want to say, Mike?
That's all. Thanks.
Bye-bye. And our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Tim about what's going on in there. Now, my understanding, of course, is that they're having a lot of problems in Nigeria as well. This conflict between the Muslims, who are being supported by our good friends in Saudi Arabia, and the Christians there, really was brought to a boil actually on September 11th. They knew the attack was coming in the United States, and they were all prepared. The Muslims were all prepared to attack the Christians. Now, because the FBI and the CIA, oh shucks, we had no idea what was going to happen. And just Zacharias Messiah told us what was going to happen, then we could have done something about it. But I remember Peter Hammond being our guest, telling us that far more people died in Nigeria on September 11, 2001, as a result of the planned attack on the Christians by the Muslims than died in New York City. Did you ever hear that story?
Yes, I did hear a report on that, and apparently what happened is they looked at the 9/11 attacks as being kind of like initiation of jihad and an excuse to go out and enact revenge on the Christians. Nigeria is also the biggest country in terms of population, although those population statistics are questionable because of the different politics that are involved with that. But you have in the north quite a large Muslim population, and they have been violently involved with the Christians in the south, and much like Sudan in that regard, and a lot of different insurgencies and terrorist activities and things like that as well. And it's created a lot of instability in Nigeria.
However, Nigeria really is a very, very wealthy country as far as natural resources.
Yes, it is. Nigeria is a major oil exporter. However, the economy of Nigeria is not very well managed. A lot of that money winds up in Swiss bank accounts and different corruption schemes. And so Nigeria remains impoverished in many ways.
Well, of course, we can even look at just south of our own border. Mexico has all the sorts of natural resources and silver and oil. They have more billionaires in Mexico than all the rest of South America put together. The only trouble is, of course, that the billionaires keep their money, do not invest it, do not use it to help the people, and the people are impoverished, and so they are invading America with the full help and support of our own Bush administration. But then the Clinton administration did the same thing. It just happens to be worse right now. And I fear we're going to see the same instability in America today that we're seeing in other parts of the world. But the average American says, oh, that could never happen here. Well, you know, the tragedy of what's unfolding in Africa today is really almost unbelievable. As we look at the economy of South Africa, our industries moving in. I know when I was there, why, you had Toyota, you had many of the major automobile companies moving in, and people were moving in because there was a good, you know, stable workforce. But my understanding is that after we brought freedom to South Africa, the chaos that this brought actually led to many of those industries leaving. Are industries coming, leaving, or staying pretty stable?
For a while, many of the industries had left, but right now, things seem to be settling down and people aren't moving. Life is just kind of, it's going on. People are trying to make money, although it is fairly difficult to do that there.
Well, now, haven't a lot of your professional people, your doctors, your people, your educated people, left South Africa to come to the United States or other countries where they, they're not sense the instability that they sense in Africa?
There has been a major, what we call a brain drain, where people going through universities, as soon as they get their degree or any form of qualification, they've been moving overseas. A lot of the white population has moved overseas. I believe 10% of the population of New Zealand is actually South African. There's a large group of South Africans that have gone to London or to England, and then as well as the United States. So there's a lot of South Africans that have moved out to try to look for better prospects elsewhere. And it's left quite a big vacuum in South Africa, and even some of the infrastructure is being affected. I know our power system and our power supplies in South Africa are in a very bad way. We've had major power outages in Cape Town, and which has led to water contamination, things that were just completely unheard of 10, 15 years ago.
All right. Sydney, what about what's happened to the value of your currency there in South Africa itself? You were commenting, Sydney, what had happened to the value of the currency in Rhodesia, where, of course, you're talking 150,000 or more Rhodesian dollars to the American dollar. When I was in South Africa, when we arrived there, the rand, it would cost you about $1.50, $1.30 to get one South African rand. And then, of course, they devalued the rand when I was there, so that it was about 80 cents American for a rand. Lost about 50% of its value when I was there. What's happened since then to the value of the rand? And, of course, so many of the people there would have their pensions tied to the value of your currency. Have they maintained the stability of your currency?
Well, what's happened is the current exchange rate is about roughly around 6 rand to the dollar. It had fluctuated quite dramatically since 1998. It was about 4. It went up to 12 rand to the dollar, and now it's back down to 6. So it's fluctuated quite a bit. In the 1970s, you could, for 1,000 rand, you could buy a car. In the 1980s, 4,000 rand, you could buy a motorcycle. In the 1990s, 4,000 rand, you can buy a bicycle. Now, 1,000 rand will buy you tennis shoes.
That's amazing, and that, of course, is what happens when a currency is being destroyed. As the currency is being destroyed in South Africa, it's in the process of being destroyed here in the United States. Now, what about the law and order? When I was there, you could even go walking at nighttime, you know, in our neighborhood, you never even gave it a second thought. What's happened, you know, in South Africa since Nelson Mandela came to power and opened up the prisons and let all the murderers and rapists out on the streets?
Yes, what we've seen is in South Africa, since the new constitution came in, there's been an abolishment of the death penalty. Even for Mandela's birthday, he let a whole bunch of prisoners from prison. The murder rate in South Africa is horrendous. We're competing with Colombia as being the number one crime capital in the world. Violent crime is quite rampant there. People live behind big security gates, big walls, razor wire, closed circuit television cameras. It's amazing the extent and the amount of money that's being pumped into security in South Africa alone. It has become very violent. The security systems on the vehicles are very sophisticated, and such that if somebody wants to steal your car, they're not going to steal it out of the parking lot. They're going to wait till you drive to the stop street. As soon as you get to the stop street, they're going to stick a gun to your head, they're going to blow your brains out, they'll pull your body out of the car, and they'll drive off to the car, because there's just very little respect for life there.
What a tragic situation for what was once a very strongly Christian nation. I'll never forget when the president of South Africa was speaking to an audience of blacks. I think there were 3 million blacks that came to hear him and applaud the white president of South Africa. Not a word in the American press about the massive support for the white regime there in South Africa from the blacks, who realized, of course, what was going to happen, when the white regime was replaced with the communist that our government was so intent upon installing. And really what a tragedy it's been to see that nation, which we lived in, my wife and I, we were there for 3 years. We loved it very much. But, of course, it has been gradually just simply declining into chaos. And really, there is an increasing state of lawlessness there, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
What's the church doing in South Africa to counter what's going on?
Unfortunately, not a whole lot. We see in terms of the church's activity being very introspective and not necessarily involved in the political arena or involved in the social arena.
And of course, when good people do nothing, why evil triumphs. We'll be right back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Well, Tim, you were just saying that the church really isn't doing much of anything in South Africa.
There are a few small groups of people that are making a noise and trying to do their best, and through some very clever strategies and things have really kind of slumped or slowed down some of the processes. There's a Christian political party that's made a lot of noise, but they aren't managing themselves too well, and they're having a lot of obstacles that they're facing. At the end of the day, I mean, it's an uphill battle.
What about Chief Buthelezi over there with the Zulus? Is he still a political force in the country?
Buthelezi, not so much anymore. He was for a while, but his influence is diminished quite a bit.
Of course, what the other side does is they infiltrate the opposition. They've done that, of course, here in the United States. Most of our conservative organizations have been infiltrated and neutralized. Most of our Christian organizations have been infiltrated and neutralized. Many of our Christian radio ministries and television ministries have been infiltrated and neutralized. And there really is no effective opposition to what's going on here in the United States. And I guess the same thing would be fairly true in Africa, you know. You weren't there when I was there, and this was in the 70s, before there was television. And I really think that television has had a tremendous deleterious effect on the survivability of the and the morality of the society. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say that from what I've heard, I mean, I obviously wasn't present at the time, but from what I've heard is before television came into on the scene in South Africa, it only came quite a bit later. You know, there was a lot of people going to Bible studies. There was a lot of activity in the church. The church was very involved in society. As soon as the television came into play, Bible studies were being canceled because of this program and that program. And they said, well, no, we'll start again as soon as the season's over or whatever. They never started again, and the church has since diminished quite dramatically.
And Chris, we were there when television came in. Before that, you'd go over to somebody's house and you'd sit around and talk. And after television came in, everybody wanted to sit around and watch television. And the images on that screen then were shaping the reality of the people. And it was at that time my wife and I decided that we better come home, because the battle for the survival of Western civilization is not in South Africa. The battle is here in America. As America goes, so goes the world, and we have an obligation to do our best. And just as Tim is spreading the word of God in Africa, you should be helping us spread the word of God here in the United States. Tim Keller, thank you so very much for being with us. I really appreciate what you're doing over there. And, of course, when you see Peter, why give him our best, will you?
Thanks, will do.
Good night, and God bless you.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, our guest has been Tim Keller, Frontline Fellowship. Certainly deserving of your consideration of help. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and quite frankly, we do need your help as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, trying to point out the fact that we're involved in a spiritual battle. being fought on a political battlefield. And unless you understand that, very little of what's going on today makes sense. There really are spiritual forces. There are supernatural forces at work in our society today. There are demonic beings, people who are possessed by dark and sinister spirits of forces, whose goal is to destroy America and to use America's military and financial power to bring about a one-world government and to bring tyranny and dictatorships to countries throughout the world. And as our leaders talk about democracy, look and see who they're installing. Right now we're in the process of destroying the government in Nepal and bring the Maoists to power. There are Maoist guerrillas operating openly in India today. Of course, we do everything we can to support the Maoist regime that is operating in China. In fact, their leader was in Washington, D.C. today. And we're doing everything we can to transfer military supplies and military know-how and technology to communist China, building up the best enemy money could buy. If you've not seen my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, or read his books, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, or Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, why, you really need to get our material. But my interview with Professor Sutton is really, I think, a classic. Wall Street, it's called The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. And so when you understand, we have financed communism since its inception. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to read it. You need to find out how the secret societies operating in America have always funded communism. And, of course, if you have not yet read the book by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, and his book, Fire in the Minds of Men, where he talks about how there was a continuing revolution. It began with the American Revolution, and then the French Revolution in 1789, and then a series of revolutions in France, how Karl Marx was financed by a secret society, how the foundation of all of these secret societies comes from the occult. And until you understand that, nothing makes sense. And once you understand it, then it all makes sense, because although perhaps Mr. James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, doesn't understand the spiritual implications of these occult organizations, if you understand the Bible and the message of the Bible, why we're told, of course, that these occult organizations are really very real, and of course they all tie into the other dimension, the satanic dimension. There truly is a battle going on today for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. So our plea to you is, of course, go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pull down our newsletters. Listen to our radio programs there at 5 hours every day, directly or indirectly on the other networks we're on. Encourage other people to listen. Get our material, distribute it, and then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if there's not a great revival in America, if the American people don't turn back to God, do you know any reason why God should protect us during the coming nuclear war? And ladies and gentlemen, there is a coming nuclear war. We are moving towards World War III and the destruction of our economy. And all the things you think are going to give you security, like your money and your pensions and your bonds and your CDs, I think will soon be lost. And he asked, bit of history, and then please pray for Radio Liberty.